On December the 24th, 1968, Apollo astronaut William Anders was orbiting the lunar surface in Apollo 8, turning his camera to face Earth.
Oh, I got it right. Oh, that's a beautiful shot.
He captured a truly historic image. For the first time, we could see our planet as it really is, a globe, seemingly suspended in space. A marble-like swirl of blue and white and golden green. 4 years later, Apollo 17 captured a shot of our entire planet without any shade cast by the moon.
America, Houston, I think this is what you wanted to hear, your go for TEI.
The photograph is called the Blue Marble. Before these photographs were taken, we had imagined our planet resembling a school globe. A map of blue and gold stretched out over a sphere. In the early seasons of Star Trek, that is how planets were portrayed. Before Earthrise, no one had imagined Earth as a marble-like swirl of blue, white, and golden green. Except for Plato. 2,500 years ago, that is exactly how Plato described planet Earth. But how could he possibly have known? Where did he get his unearthly information from? Is it possible that Plato knew and described how planet Earth looked like from space, from a distance, because he was a contactee?
Before we get into today's content, on behalf of the Fifth Kind TV, I want to say a big thank you to Surfshark for sponsoring today's content. Surfshark is a VPN that allows us all to become citizens of the world through online access. If you're like me, you'll enjoy watching online content from countries all around the world. But I live in Australia, and what I'm shown in internet searches will be different to what you're shown in Canada, America, the Philippines, Germany, the Netherlands, or wherever you're watching from. By using Surfshark, I'm able to access a world of online content and see all the things that you see and many other things beside. Surfshark enables us to become citizens of the world through online availability.
Get fully protected. Follow the link in the description. Sign up and use the promo code FIFTHKIND to receive an 85% discount. Plus, you'll get 4 months for free. Surfshark offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you try it and you don't like it, you can easily cancel your subscription and receive a full refund. With Surfshark, you can swim under the radar in the sea of online content.
Plato was an ancient Athenian educator. His real name was Aristocles of Athens, and he lived from around 427 to 348 before Common Era. Plato was actually his wrestling handle, because as well as an educator in science and philosophy, he also taught wrestling. Now, I believe Plato probably was a contactee. And I'm going to explain why I think that in a moment. But before we get there, I need to say something about the way in which Plato taught. Now, Plato was a student of Socrates. And in his writings, Plato presents his teachings as the recollections of conversations among Socrates and his students. We know the most about Socrates' teaching through the writings of Plato and his fellow student, Xenophon. And I think it's fair to say that Plato goes broader and more deeply into the implications of Socrates' teaching, albeit Plato's method is a little different. Plato wrote conversations, and so we have a number of characters speaking in his books. We have Phaedo, Timaeus, Critias, Echecrates, Sabes, Simmias, and many others besides. And in fact, there's a joke that Plato puts at the beginning of his book Phaedo, which says, "Only Plato was absent for this conversation. I think he was unwell." In that way, Plato has put a little in-joke between himself and you, the reader, to say, look, this is not actually a verbatim recollection of real conversations between Socrates and his students. I've fictionalized it a little bit, just so that I can play with some of the ideas that we're talking about. And Plato's play extended beyond that, because what we have to realize is that everything spoken in his books is spoken by Plato. Every character that speaks those words have been written by Plato. So when Socrates speaks, yes, we can take it as a recollection of Socrates' wisdom, but it's actually Plato who is making all these points for his reader. And every other speaker that speaks, it's Plato's words. And what that means is that Plato can put forward teaching in the name of Socrates, but he can also put forward his own ideas and speculations, and he can argue against himself. And what that means is that we need to take seriously everything that is spoken by every character, because even if there's a minor-seeming character who makes a point that's then lambasted by Socrates, just note, Plato wanted us to hear what this other character had said. And using devices like these, Plato draws information from a number of sources and then presents them in a coherent way, arguing for them on the basis of logic. Plato names the following sources of information. Firstly, there's what we might call science, logic applied to things we can all observe. And then there is information derived from ancestral narratives. And so Plato refers to information from ancient Egypt that was passed on to a real historical character, Solon, the Greek legislator, whose grandson Critias was a fellow student with Plato in the class of Socrates. So we've got ancestral story. And of course, within the Egyptian story, there's other international thought that's arrived there. Characters can speak about what is commonly known, and that may be a synthesis of international thought. Plato also refers to information derived from transpersonal experiences. Experience is gained through a tea ceremony at the Eleusinian sect. He's referring to the Koukion ceremony, which was a near-death protocol, very carefully curated through the use of a psychoactive tea. It was the protocol of the Eleusinian sect. And Plato refers to a couple of other sects as well, the cult of Hecate and the cult of Orpheus, which may also have had similar near-death protocols. And in those altered states, Plato refers to contact experiences and information derived that way. All those sources of information are synthesized in Plato's work, brought together, and he argues for the conclusions that he reaches. So I want to go to one of these characters who says in passing something about planet Earth. So this is Timaeus speaking in the book Timaeus and Critias. He says, "The Earth is spherical and it revolves on its axis." And elsewhere, Socrates speaks of the planet being round like a soccer ball, seemingly suspended in space, and from a distance, it's a swirl of blue and gold and white. Elsewhere in Phaedo, Socrates says this, "I have been convinced that if the earth is round and in the middle of the heavens, it needs neither air nor any other such force to prevent its falling, that the uniformity of the heaven in every direction with itself is enough to support it, together with the equilibrium of the earth itself. It is vast in size, and we who dwell between the Phasis River and the Pillars of Heracles inhabit only a small part of it. If one views it from above, It is said to look like those 12-piece leather balls, variegated, a patchwork of colors. One portion is purple, marvelous for its beauty. Another is golden, and all that is whiter than chalk or snow. Given that there were plenty of people living at that time who still believed the Earth was flat and underneath a firmament, this is pretty prescient information. Now let's pause and ask how Socrates/Plato could have possibly known that. Now remember, it's very difficult to get a piece of paper between Socrates and Plato. So I'm going to be referring to all this knowledge as Plato's knowledge. How could Plato have known the planet Earth looked like that from a distance? Had he seen an image? Or had an image been described to him by a source he's not going to credit? Now, Plato is fairly open about crediting sources. So I'm intrigued as to how Plato is so confident as to describe this in more than one place in his writings. Plato goes further than describing what the planet looks like from space to talk about space itself. And in his language about space, he clearly breaks through that whole concept of the firmament. We call the air heaven, as if this were heaven and the stars moved through it, whereas in truth, because of our lack of power and our lack of speed, we are unable to pass through the summit of the air. For were anyone to go through its surface or gain wings and fly high enough, he would stick his head up and see, just as there are fishes of the sea that stick their heads up and see things here, so he would see the things up there. And if his nature were able to bear the vision, he would realize that this is the true heaven, the genuine light, and the true earth. Here, Plato is saying that if we had the technology to generate enough power to travel fast enough, we could get beyond the atmosphere. That's our language today. Get beyond the atmosphere and see into deep space. And he unpacks that concept further, just so that we're clear what he really is saying, in a section where he speaks about other kinds of being who have this knowledge of deep space as it really is. He says, among many other living things, there are people, some dwelling in land, some living in the air, just as we can live on the sea, and some on islands in the air, surrounded by air. They are free from sickness and live a far longer time than people here, and they surpass us in sight, hearing, wisdom, and all such faculties. The sun, moon, and stars are seen by them as they really are, and their happiness and all else accords with that. This vision of people living on islands in the sky is not the monopoly of Plato and Socrates. We hear the same language used by the Efik people of Nigeria, who speak about advanced beings, Abasi and Atai, living on an island in the sky and having a role in the engineering of Homo sapiens in the deep past. But these teachings about space really go together, because here Plato is saying, if we could generate the power and had the speed, we could get beyond the atmosphere and see deep space as it really is. There are people who have done that, and they are similar to us, but they're more intelligent, they live longer, they don't get sick, and they live on islands in the sky. Now today, we have other language for people like that, and we would call them extraterrestrials. It's not the only place where Plato hints at present-day contact. In Timaeus and Critias, Socrates describes four kinds of living creature. What's so interesting about this is that Plato draws no distinction between those kinds of being. He doesn't say three of these are real and one of them isn't, or three are real, physical, and one is imaginary. He talks about different kinds of creatures, those who live under the sea, those who live on land, those who live in the air, and those who live in space. And when we see in translations God from the heavens, we need to be very careful about that language, because Plato makes clear what he means by God and what he means by heavens. Unfortunately, we mean something else by those words. Heavens to us is a religious word. God is a religious or transcendent concept. But Plato is very clear to define the word God or theos in the Greek. He says God can be one of two things. It can be either the personification of a planet or a star or a sun, or it can refer to an advanced being, advanced beings which interacted with our ancestors to raise our intelligence. And once again, he describes them in this four creatures section as a flesh and bone reality. The only difference is where they live, that they are extraterrestrial and do not live on Earth. They live in space. Now, how can Plato speak so confidently about these other kinds of being? He's talked about their technology, the power they can generate, the speed they can move at, the craft that they live on, which he calls islands in the sky. He says they have an understanding of deep space, that they're very intelligent, that they're very healthy and long-lived. How does he know all this? It's not all spelled out because he doesn't tell us in a single place, and it's not a single character giving us this information. But he goes on to talk about contact experiences in another section of his writings. He refers to contact in the present, and he refers to contact in the deep past, which I think we can call an invasion. In Timaeus and Critias, Critias says, once upon a time, the gods divided up the whole earth between them according to its regions. Each gladly received his just allocation and settled his territories. The various gods then administered the various regions which had been allotted to them. In my book, The Invasion of Eden, I show how this narrative of invasion exists all around the world. We can find it in the story of Mo'o and the Ahumanu from ancient Hawaii. We can find it in the Bible and its stories of the Tseva Hashemayim, the sky armies, which became the El Ba'adat, the Council of Power, dividing up Earth's territories in Psalm 82, and Deuteronomy 32. It's there also in the ancient stories of Mesopotamia. Plato describes it matter of fact in the words of Critias, and none of the other people in that class contradict what Critias has to say. So certainly there's contact in the deep past, but Plato takes us further and describes contact experiences in the present day. In Phaedo, Socrates speaks about what happens to us when we die. Now it is said that when each one has died, the spirit allotted to each in life proceeds to bring that individual to a certain place, where those gathered must submit to judgment, and then journey to Hades with the guide appointed to conduct those in this world to the next. And when they have experienced there the things they must and stayed there for the time required, another guide conveys them back here during many long cycles of time. This path seems to me neither simple nor single, but then there would be no need of guides. And I speak from the evidence of the rites and observances followed here. What Plato / Socrates is speaking about is a near-death protocol that was very carefully curated by the officiants of the Eleusinian sect in ancient Athens. Now, this near-death protocol used a psychoactive tea called kukion to alter the state of consciousness of the devotee and modulate their brain waves to the point where they're beginning to perceive things they don't usually perceive and experience contact with entities they would not usually perceive. And in that state, conversations happen to coach the person who's drunk the tea in how to return to this life more intelligently and live a more conscious, courageous, confident, and intelligent life. Now, this is very similar to the experience of psychoactive teas around the world today. And these kinds of conversations and experiences are widely reported. Plato sows the information from this experience into his teachings in other places, in Phaedo and Timaeus and Critias and the Republic. And it's from these experiences that he gains his belief that we all have an invisible team of helpers around us whose desire is to help coach us through this life for the sake of a better human experience. It's from these experiences that Plato has concluded that we are here to have experiences and to learn things on behalf of the cosmos, and that we will have a better experience of this if we can learn to shake off the heavier emotions, as he calls them, things like rage, fury, unforgiveness, resentment, trauma, terror, unfulfilled ambition. If we can shake those off and learn to vibrate at a higher frequency, to use that language, if we can operate out of love and joy and curiosity and compassion, that is the wise path and that is the better experience. And we move on from that to the next experience more easily, he says. Now, all these conclusions, for which Plato was criticized by later generations because they said he sounded too Christian, never mind that he lived half a millennium before Christianity. These conclusions he reached through, I believe, his personal experience of the Kukion ceremony. Now, it's all put on the lips of Socrates, but when you connect the dots of the teachings derived from this experience, you realize Plato is describing it with such interiority, it really has to be an experience that Plato had had himself. He believed it was real. He believed the guides were real. He was a little agnostic as to who the guides were, whether they were the spirits of ancestors or a totally different kind of interdimensional being here to support our progress through life. But the contact was real. And so already we have a number of kinds of being that Plato is attesting to. There's us. There's those who live on islands in the sky. There are the guides that we meet in altered states of consciousness. And then there's the craftsman. And the craftsman is the demiurge, a kind of being who is involved in creating the world as we know it, terraforming this planet, to use today's language. And again, this view of our planet's history and our history as a species is not exclusive to Plato. We can find these stories told by the Iroquois people, by indigenous Filipino narratives, by the Enuma Elish of ancient Sumeria. And as I argue in my Eden series, it's there in the Hebrew scriptures as well, in the pages of Genesis. Now, Plato spreads all this teaching about other kinds of being, including those with whom he has had contact through the Kukion ceremony. It's there in Phaedo, Timaeus and Critias, and the Republic, but he doesn't put it all in one space, spoken by one voice, because it would be overwhelming. And in fact, in his book, The Republic, Plato explains why he has done this, and he does it in his most famous passage of all, his passage about the cave. In his book, The Republic, Plato describes this world and the condition of human beings as being like that of people who are confined in a cave. They are chained in such a way that they can't move their heads to see each other as they really are. All they can do is look at a wall in front of them and see projections of themselves cast by a fire that's burning behind them. They're seeing shadows, believing that they are seeing the real world. And then Plato asks us to imagine what would happen if a person were to break out of their chains and walk out of that cave into the real world. Plato says, of course, at first the experience would be blinding and quite painful, and the person would be unable to see the world as it really is because it would be overwhelming. And instead of looking at things as they really are, he might prefer to look at reflections in water, and then gradually his eyes would acclimatize and he would see the sky and the land and the trees and the plants and the creatures and himself, and realize that a whole new dimensionality has been added to his understanding of the world and the human condition. And then when he looks back into the cave, he would have to feel overwhelming compassion for those trapped in that dark condition where they're only looking at shadows and they're in chains, but they don't realize it. Such a person, says Plato, would feel compelled to return to the cave to help his peers. And this is all an analogy, and he says the person would clearly need to go back as an educator or go into politics because they would want to change the human experience for the better now they've seen things as they really are. The problem is that if the enlightened person goes back into the cave, he can't tell the people in the cave everything he has seen and now knows to be true, because it would be overwhelming. It would be unbelievable. They would be unable to imagine it. They would think he was crazy. And so instead, he must behave as one in chains, as one only looking at shadows, but revealing his new knowledge only piece by piece, here and there, to help people gradually escape from that slave-like condition. Plato is describing himself. He's saying he has had that experience. He has escaped from the cave. He has seen things as they really are. And he now is revealing piece by piece the knowledge he has gained so that you and I might break out of the matrix, to use that language, and see things as they really are. Understand ourselves as we really are so that you and I can have a better human experience. Socrates wrestled with the decision of whether to go into politics to try and change things that way, or go into education, believing that if the people are more intelligent and more conscious, it demands a more intelligent form of government. Emotionally intelligent people can't be manipulated by a xenophobe or a rabble-rouser. They demand a more intelligent and enlightened form of government. Plato made the same decision, and he gives the background to it in this analogy of the cave. And so he's telling us, if I just told you outright everything I've seen and know to be true, you would think I was crazy, you would struggle to take it on board, but instead I've scattered it throughout my writings so you can connect the dots and see what I'm saying. And Plato's far-reaching information was so prescient, was so advanced, that the British mathematics philosopher Alfred North Whitehead famously described the whole of the Western tradition of philosophy as no more than a series of footnotes to Plato, and no one felt the need to disagree with him. Plato is a genius and one of the great minds of all time. This is the information he's given us about these other kinds of being and the possibility of contact in the present and the certainty of contact in the deep past. And that's why you'll find Plato in every one of my books: Escaping from Eden, The Scars of Eden, Echoes of Eden, The Eden Conspiracy, The Invasion of Eden, and in the title that's on its way. Because that great mind put us in a populated cosmos and said the implications of that are that we might understand deep space as it really is, and ourselves as we really are. And his hope in the light of all of that is that you and I might be more wise, more intelligent, more conscious, and have a better human experience together.
Thank you for watching The Fifth Kind TV. Remember to subscribe and click on the bell for notifications so that you never miss when we upload new content. For uncensored access to our full interviews and documentaries, go to fifthkind.tv. For more videos about paleo contact and the wisdom of the world's ancestral narratives, go to the Paul Wallace channel, subscribe, and click on the bell. Thank you for watching The Fifth Kind TV.